This is RNIB Connect Radio.
I'm Ravi Sagu, and a very warm welcome to Blind Notes on RNIB Connect Radio. In this conversation series, I'll be speaking to different musicians each week, exploring their portfolio of work, their own musical loves, inspirations, and what drives them to perform the music they make. I myself have experience of visual issues as I suffer from keratoconus, and I'm keen to explore how our guests have overcome their visual disabilities to make their own music and achieve their musical goals. Our guest today hails from Hitchin in Hertfordshire, and given there was always music in our house, it's not surprising she studied music and has made a name for herself performing her songs and cover versions online, as well as singing on the BBC programme All Together Now. She's also Scotland's first ever blind musical director, and I've dragged her out of rehearsals along with her piano to join me today. Welcome to Blind Notes, Sally Clay. Sally, lovely to have you with us today.
Hiya.
Sally, before we go straight into our deep, meaningful conversation and some, I'm just getting this vibe already. I'm really excited. There's one particular track that I want to play for a number of reasons, because I actually own a pair of cowboy boots, believe it or not. Never had any issues with my height at all, obviously, right?
I want them.
Well,
lend them to me, do you think?
If you're a size 9, you can take it.
No, I'm a size 5, so I'll be rubbish. They'll be like cowboy boats.
Stick some socks in them and you can take it, Lena. But
okay.
Let's hear a little something from your repertoire. This is Sally Clay and Cowboy Song.
Well, if God was a cowboy, as I believe he maybe was, he'd choose old cheroots and give a little shrug. Hitch his horse to the running pole, shift his blanket against the cold. Just wait.
Sally Clay there with Cowboy Song. Sally, great to have you on the show today. You're going to also treat us to some live music. And before we sort of venture into your background, tell me about that song, Cowboy Song.
Cowboy Song was from a musical called Raspberry that I did kind of around 2010, 2012. It's written by a very sort of prominent disabled writer, actor, director called Gary Robson. And I kind of chipped in as well. There's another guy called Lee Sterling that wrote it. It was kind of a collaboration between us, but it was kind of, it went up to Lee first, who was the writer, and then I got my hands on it and kind of wrote the music for the chorus, but the lyrics were already done by Gary. So anyway, he put it in this musical called Raspberry, and Raspberry was inspired by the life and times of Ian Dury. But in it, there are all these characters, and ironically enough, I played Ray Charles, right. Even though I'm white and I was pregnant and and yeah, female. So, and it's kind of like there's a girl in it called Rita, and it's about her journey through her sort of family dynamic and how she sort of discovers herself by meeting these kind of cockeyed versions of Ian Dury, Albert Einstein and Ray Charles. Yeah, so I played Ray in that, and a Cowboy Song was the song that Ray sang when Rita was kind of at her turning point.
So help me with your rhythm stick. What instruments were there in your house growing up?
Well, when I was about, I think even when I was born, but I don't remember it really up until I was about four, we had this Hammond organ, but I don't really know how it compares to other Hammond organs, but all I can tell you is it was massive. It was bigger than this keyboard that I've got here in kind of width, and it had all these stops on the top, these kind of like black keys at the bottom. So normally you've got black keys in the piano, you've got the black keys on the top, the raised keys are the black keys, and then you've, and they're the sharps and flats, and then you've got the white keys underneath that. But it was the other way around at one point during this keyboard, so you could sort of see where the left hand began and the right hand ended. And I had a tiny bit of vision then, so you could sort of see. So we had that. We had this crazy Hammond, and it had all these different sounds. It was really old school, really old school. And you had these big pedals that made it louder and softer at the bottom. And I learned how to play piano on that. We had recorders. We had just rubbishy little xylophones that were always out of tune, you know, that every kid has in their house. Drums made out of like little biscuit tins and, you know, all the kind of just crazy kid stuff. And I think, to be honest, we did a lot of singing. That was mainly what my sister and I did. I used to play on the keyboard, and then we did loads of singing. We're just singing all the time.
Well, I'm glad you're in front of the keys today and not me, I tell you. I say that genuinely. Sally, tell me your story. You were born blind, yes?
Yeah. So I was born with a tiny bit of vision. I'm not going to go into every aspect of my eye condition because you'd be here all week and it'd be incredibly boring. But suffice to say that I had probably about 3% of what a sighted person could see. And over years, very, very slowly, so that I could kind of get used to it. It's really lucky, actually. It deteriorated, but I didn't really notice until one day I looked at something and I thought, I can't see that anymore. So, I think I've only ever really been able to see up to about a metre in front of me with any kind of detail. And then now, as an adult, I'm just basically functionally totally blind. I can see light, but it's completely pointless. I think my brain's just kind of given up and gone, yeah, you don't need that. You can just use your ears. It's easier.
And unlike some of our guests on Blind Notes, you actually attended a mainstream school
that's right.
A blind journalist. So tell me about the challenges that you faced in this situation.
I found loads of things really interesting about it. Like there were challenges. I think the isolation was the biggest challenge. And it was just about, you know, a lot of things when you're young, a lot of games that you do at school are based on copying and mimicking the other kids and things like that. And because I kind of remember, you know, being really young and always in my family, always being, I don't think I even knew that I was blind. I just think I thought, because I've got one eye, so I've got one prosthetic eye, and I just thought, well, they can see out of two and I can see out of one, so that's why I'm blind, because they've got two eyes and I've got one. So I didn't really sort of put two and two together and think, actually, they've got 97% more sight than me. I just kind of thought, well, you know, they can see a bit more than me and that's fine. And that's why I can't see the blackboard, because my eyes don't work. But I didn't really think in any kind of comparative terms. So I didn't really understand why they weren't kind of playing with me, or they kind of gave me funny looks when I came and said hello. And I think it was just because I didn't know when to interject in conversations. I didn't always know how to do the right dances that people did. I didn't know, you know, if people were playing a game, maybe I just kind of like barged in and didn't even realise that they were right in the middle of something. And I just kind of, you know, and I was the only blind girl in my family, the only blind girl at school. I had this massive, I don't know if you had these, Ravi, but I had this like massive screen where you put like a magnifier and you put your stuff underneath it and it magnifies it to the size of ridiculousness, like 60 times. And you used to put your book underneath it and it would sort of slide from left to right and you'd read it. So there was no way I was going to make any mates with that, because it took up like three desks.
And especially kids at that age, you know, like when we're at school, you know, we can all be little so-and-sos at times as well. So that probably doesn't help either.
No, it doesn't. And I think also, yeah, that they were. And I think I was a little so-and-so. You know, I mean, I was quite opinionated. I was very loud. I always wanted to be centre of attention. But I think part of that was just seeking the connection with them. And I think sometimes I just didn't find that connection necessarily because it's almost like we were speaking a different language sometimes. And I just had to, it took me a long time to sort of learn the language.
You've described me growing up as a middle child in my household, but that's another story. Right?
Yeah, middle kids do have it tough.
I believe music helped you overcome the isolation feelings by playing piano at break time.
That's right. When I got to about 12 and puberty kicked in, I got really depressed because I was like, this is just so rubbish. All the girls are getting boyfriends and, you know, and they're all kind of hanging out in their cliques. And I felt a little bit alone. So that was kind of depressing me a bit. But what my dad said to me one day, I think I came home and I was in tears or something. And he said, look, you've got a really good way in here. You know, you can play the piano. If you learn like your latest pop songs, then you could entertain the kids on the piano. They're all going to want to come up to see you. Then you can get to know them and you can find out what your sort of friends group is, you know. And actually, he went and spoke to the teachers and asked if I'd be given permission to do that in wet break times. And so, yeah, it all kind of helter-skeltered from there, really. It was amazing.
Really breaking those barriers down, you know?
Yeah, and it was like, it was literally like a magnet. You know, as soon as I started playing the piano, I met one girl, and then she gave me a Christmas card, and then somebody else came in. It was like, by the end of 3 or 4 months, it was like the whole school would come around the piano and sing.
Fantastic.
And it was just, it was the best. And I still have that. Like, every time I play the piano, people still do that. And I don't know whether it's because of the happiness that I feel and that connection that they kind of gravitate towards that. You know, and I feel really lucky to have that, because some people don't.
What kind of music were you listening to and playing at that stage then? Give me a wee example.
Okay, well, I was doing, you know, all that stuff from Greece, you know. Summer loving happens so fast. Summer loving, happy at blast. Did it, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then I was doing Culture Beat. So they used, all the kids used to like line up next to me with their lunch boxes and go, play Mr. Vane, play Mr. Vane. So I'd have to go like, this is how I used to play. I know what I want and I want it now. I want you because I'm Mr. Vane. You know, that's kind of how I used to sing. And then there was a song called Mooning from Greece. And it was kind of a lesser known song. It was, I think it was like on the radio when they're doing, I can't remember what it was, when the Pink Ladies are doing their thing, you know, like piercing Sandy's ears or whatever. And they have like, spend my nights just mooning all over you, all over you. And I used to sing all that as well. And just, I think it was Bryan Adams. You know, Everything I Do, I think I used to
Which
do
was
that
at
as
number
well.
One for
yeah,
weeks
it was
upon
weeks.
Weeks.
Weeks. So yeah. It was like, you know, it's true. Everything I do it for you. You know, I used to kind of play that, but it was the whole song, you know, and I'd play it from beginning to end as per the CD. I didn't have my own spin then. It was just literally like, because they wanted copies. They wanted it to be like they were at home listening to their record or their CD.
You turned the tables. You were the cool kid at school. And I'll openly admit to this as well, Sally. I'm a huge fan of Grease.
Yay! Cool.
Going back to your school days, so you were in mainstream education, but you did end up in a school for the blind when you were around 16.
Yeah, that's right.
Tell me about this. How did that experience come about?
Well, what happened was that I actually really wanted it by this point, because I didn't really know any. I knew one blind person, and although we were quite good friends, he was really different to me. Really into books and really, and he wasn't. I mean, he had brilliant taste. He still does actually have really good taste in music. So he got me into like Tori Amos and Ben Folds Five and all these great bands and like Limp Bizkit and everything, just like a whole bunch of different things that he got me into, and the Eels and things like that. But he was just really different from me. And I think that, you know, eventually he was totally blind and I had a bit of sight then. And I think I just felt that I really wanted to meet some girls who couldn't see as well, just to kind of meet some people, connect with people that maybe were going through the same stuff. So, yeah, I really wanted to go. And also the A-levels that I'd chosen, I chose to do music, French and German. And at the time, I mean, it's much different now. You know, anyone that wants to do those A-levels probably could I don't know 100%, but I think they could probably do them within the mainstream setting. But when I was growing up, I was like the first blind girl to go through mainstream system. So then trying to do French, German and music braille had problems in terms of resources that they could dedicate to that. And in terms of the production of braille music in-house, it was very difficult because there wasn't the expertise, but there also just wasn't the time, the resources, the personnel, you know, it was tough. And so I think it was kind of the general consensus, but certainly it was led by me, really. I wanted to go away to school at that point and to kind of find that part of my identity, to kind of find who I was and how I fit into both worlds, because I did definitely feel that I wanted to be in both worlds, not just in blind or sighted. You know, I wanted to feel at one with both sides of my life.
After school, your love of music took you further. You studied music at the Trinity College in London.
Yeah, Trinity College of Music. I'm
envious already.
Oh, you don't need to be.
Trust me, I am. So how daunting was that, being blind and then heading off to London alone? I mean, a massive city. You know, for anybody, I remember the first time I went to London, I was like, right, how does this tube system work? Tell me about, you know, your trip down to London for the very first time.
Well, I used to go in and out of London because my nan lived in London. My dad's from London originally. But it was always like, you know, those tube journeys where your parents are dragging you down the steps because they're in a hurry and we've got lost and we don't know where we're going. So that was kind of my experience of the tube, and I was terrified. But I mean, my parents have always been very proactive in terms of getting me to do stuff. So when I was 7, my dad kind of put me in a caravan park and said, right, I want you to find your way home from this park to the caravan on your own. And I'll meet you back there in 10 minutes or whatever, you know. And I was expected to do this. It wasn't really a choice. And it was kind of, I think, although at the time I felt it was really harsh, I think actually looking back on it was the best thing he could have done.
Yeah.
Because it's like immersion therapy, you know, it's literally just, and I think he was watching me. Now I'm back, I'm sure he was watching me. And I think I actually spoke to him about it. But, you know, it's that kind of thing. So I was kind of used to being dumped in the deep end. But I was scared because I was worried that I was going to miss my classes. I was worried about living completely alone. Although this blind school that I'd been to, it was RNIB New College at the time. And, you know, although that had furnished me with a lot of skills, you know, mobility skills, life skills, working out how to do your washing, you know, I felt confident that I could travel on the train and I could do all these things, but I still felt really worried about the underground and how I was going to find my way around all these different stations and everything. But actually, my dad showed me kind of the structure and the way that the thing worked to get from my bit to college. And it did actually work out really well. And I found that the staff down there were really helpful too. I wasn't expecting that at all. I was expecting to have to do everything on my own. And you kind of forget that, you know, you don't have to do everything on your own, that you can kind of ask for help if you want to. And I think when you're proud and young, you kind of don't. But as you get older, you just think, oh, well, to hang with it is fine. You know, it's not a problem.
So you obviously coped and developed your structure and network and logistics of getting around.
Yep.
What were you actually studying?
I was studying classical music. So I studied classical singing. So I had learnt the piano up until sort of grade 6. And I mean, I was grade 8 standard. I just didn't take the exam. Then I went and did classical singing because I sort of, during my first and second year of secondary school and all the way up to then, I'd kind of discovered that I was very into singing, that I really liked it. And actually, people always wanted the blind person to play the piano. And I was like, no, I'm not playing the piano. I want to do singing because it's better. And so, yeah, I think that's why I started doing the classical singing. So, and also because of my flair for languages, I really enjoyed languages. And it was fascinated me how they worked in music and all this sort of poetry by different French and German poets and stuff. It was just a completely new world for me. So I just found that really great. And the discipline that you got there, it was brutal, but in a really good way. So you basically, it was like getting undressed in front of, you didn't actually do that, but it was felt like you were being musically undressed in front of all your colleagues and your classmates, because literally you'd go in there, you'd perform a song and they'd go, well, to be honest, that just sounded like a shopping list. And you'd go, oh my God. And, you know, people would cry and they'd walk out and stuff. But if you could get through that and you could kind of learn that by being broken down like that, you could rebuild yourself. It was actually really a really fascinating experience. And I think some people found that really, really scary. And I did find it scary, but I also kind of rekindled my sort of love of music and my love of performance from the ashes of that.
A schooling in itself. Can you give us a wee burst of some of the things that you were doing at Trinity?
Yeah, this is a song called Après un Rêve, and it's by Gabriel Fauré. And it's all about love, which is most of his stuff. This is one that I recorded when I was still at Trinity. Oh,
You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio. This is Blind Notes with Ravi Sagu, and I'm in conversation with Sally Clay. Sally, what was your next move after Trinity? So, you know, what I'm really interested to hear about is you've obviously studied music at this point. Was it difficult to find a job in music?
Really difficult, and especially the kind of personality that I've got. I'm very good at doing things when I have an externally motivated direction. You know, like if I need to do a show, I will learn everything. I'll write the music. I'll do everything that I need to do. See, if you just leave me in this pool of freedom, I'll just be like, yeah, I'll just sit on my laurels. I won't do anything, you know. And so I found it very difficult to find that self-motivation. I mean, the music was still there. I could still learn stuff. I could still play, but I found it, I don't think I found my voice, and I still sometimes feel that I haven't found my voice, but I think now as a theatre musician and stuff, I can live with that because diversity is really useful in that environment. But at the time, I wasn't a theatre musician, and I was just trying to find my voice doing like jazz standards and not having necessarily the piano agility that the jazz pianists have, and having some good vocal skills but not really having the creative knowledge or understanding of where to go. So yeah, it was difficult, and developing the promo material for yourself, you know, trying to sell CDs and demos. And
see, that's a true hustle.
Yeah.
But then I'd imagine after being involved in musical projects with other musicians at Trinity, what was it like then going back to being a solo musician then?
Oh, it was pretty bleak, to be honest. When I came out of music college, I actually went to live with a guy that I was going out with at the time. And then I did IT training for blind people for a year. So completely nothing to do with singing. But I did end up, there was a wee care home next door, and I used to go and do little concerts for them.
Fantastic.
With their little, this little organ that was like, I can't even remember. Sometimes I used to use like stand up and sing a cappella, you know. It was just so weird because I'd been used to singing, like you say, with a lot of people in choirs and like high standard playing. And then I was just standing there in this wee care home in the canteen, sort of like singing. And I just felt really lost, actually. And it was hard. But sort of, I think it was around 2003, I just had this really difficult year and just realizing that all my friends were kind of going off and doing things. And I just felt really isolated. Normally when I feel isolated, I tend to get things done. Okay. And so what I did was I responded to an advert in the Stage newspaper, and it was looking for musicians stroke actors with disabilities who could possibly work on a show called Threepenny Opera. And I thought to myself, the only way I can go is up. So, you know, because I'm at the bottom right now, so I'm going to go up.
Okay.
Yeah, I went up to Edinburgh from Hitchin and auditioned and got the part of narrator and pianist. And it basically, everything, my life changed from that point.
Fantastic. So you've obviously got your break into theatre now. You're part of the Threepenny Opera. What was that like?
It was radical. It really was. It was weird in some ways because it was lots of disabled people, but it gave, I think what it did was it cemented this belief that I could go and do things for myself, because I was living at home, back at home with my mum. I'd had two really pretty bad breakups with different guys, and I'd moved out of one house and into another and all this stuff. You know, the last thing that I wanted really was to stay at home with my mum feeling like I had no future. And then going to do Threepenny Opera, I thought this might, I just had this feeling in my gut, like this is going to give me opportunity in some way. And it was lovely. Just first thing that was lovely was to make a clean break, you know, go off to Scotland, which I'd never really explored, and then just go and go, right, I'd get on this train, I'm just going to see what happens, and I'm just going to wing it and fly by the seat of your pants. And just kind of got there. Basically, I got my stuff unpacked, moved into the flat that I was renting, and went down the pub and met a whole bunch of people that were in the show. I didn't even know they were going to be there. I just literally walked into this pub. I'd never do that. Like, as a woman, you know, some people go into the pub on their own, but a lot of people don't. But I just decided that this was what I had to do, because as a blind person, you're not going to get people gravitating towards you unless you seek that.
Yeah, I think destiny is, well, that's a whole another discussion, but it seems like you kind of really embrace destiny and your journey and kismet. You know what's coming next? Give us a little number from it.
Okay, this is called Pirate Jenny. So you all heard of the song Mac the Knife. Oh, the shark has pearly teeth, dear. Anyway, that song by Mac Heath, who's like this kind of gangster guy that's like the head of the gangsters. And he's, you know, really awful man, but very slick and very kind of seductive. And Jenny is one of his many lady friends who he kind of communes with in this harem. And Jenny, this is a song that Jenny kind of sings about men based on her experience of men and her life. And she's been through a really hard time. So yeah, it's a very interesting take on how she feels about men and the human race in general. Gentlemen, today you see me washing glasses and I make up the beds each morning. and you slip me just a penny, and I thank you with a smile, and you see me dressed in cast-offs, and you see this crap hotel, and you just don't know to whom you're talking, and you just don't know to whom you're talking. Suddenly one night there'll be a thunder at the dockside, and they'll ask, what's the shouting all about? And they'll see me next morning leaving early, and they'll say, what's she got to smile at now? And a ship with sails shining, 55 cannons white, sir, is moored at the quay.
Fantastic. In conversation and indeed in session with Sally Clay here on RNIB Connect Radio. You're listening to Blind Notes with myself, Ravi Sagu. Sally, obviously you're talking about the Throppney Opera. More theatre work led from there? What direction did the career take then?
Everything went theatre then. Everything just went theatre. So what happened was that I was employed as narrator and piano player. And because I'm blind, I do read Braille music, but I have to rely on that and my ears to access musical material, you know, to learn stuff. And I couldn't just sit and read. Normally a piano player would just sit and read the score and play. That's not an option for me, so I have to really be very familiar with the score. So basically I sat there for 2 weeks and just bombarded my brain with Throppney Opera. And it was in German, so I know quite a lot of the German Throppney Opera because I heard it so many times. And as a result of that, when I went up to start working on the show, I actually knew the show better than the musical director because I'd listened to it just so many times. And so I ended up helping the musical director quite a lot. And I think some people realised that there was maybe potential there for me to take on a leadership role in future productions of theirs. So I made a lot of contacts, and another contact that I made was a company called Limelight Music, and they were really instrumental, excuse the pun, in my development musically and theatrically. And I met my current partner there too. He was a trombone player.
I'm an old romantic, I tell you.
Oh, yeah. Lovely.
Well, let me rephrase that. I'm a youngish romantic.
Yeah, you're very young. You look marvellous.
Thank you. Thank you. Sally, now at MD yourself, now in production, that's a scary job for anybody, you know, as it is. Mm. What are the things, devices that you've learned, you know, that gave you confidence to do that job as a blind person?
I would still very much say that although I can MD things, I think that I still feel that my passion is in performing. So yes, I do MD, and I have MD'd a lot. I think the main thing that I have learnt as a blind person is that you have to be honest about the difficulties. And I think that that you need, A, to know and work with a director that understands you and be honest about what you can and can't do, and constantly be able to find ways to adapt to the show. And if things aren't working for you, then you need to be honest to the director, because how will they ever know, you know, if you don't tell them? At first, I did everything myself. Again, it was like, you know, this blind woman is going to do everything. I'm going to be all singing, all dancing, one-man band. That's going to memorise 400 cues and things like that. And I ended up nearly having a bit of a breakdown on some of the shows because it was just so much to do. You know, there's, I think, a lot of advantages that sight gives you. So I think it's just basically admitting where you need help and saying, look, I actually could do with a pair of headphones and somebody, maybe a support worker, to actually read them to me, so I don't have to worry about that and I can concentrate on what the cast are doing and maybe do my actual job rather than having to worry about those access barriers. So I think banish your pride, be honest about what you can and can't do, and also because it is extra work for a blind person to do, and be honest about how much you can take on at any given time.
And never be afraid to seek help or speak out about it, absolutely.
Yeah.
Sally, tell me about the Sounds of Progress and their company under MD Gordon Dougal.
That's right. So that was what Limelight was. It became like, it started off, I think, initially in 1989 as Strathclyde Orchestral Productions. Then I got involved. And what Sounds of Progress were doing is they were doing music, theatre, production and facilitating with disabled people. I think what really appealed to me about Gordon, who was their artistic and is their artistic director, is that he was being honest about the standard you were and gave you really honest, sometimes brutally honest, feedback about how you came across. And you really kind of knew where you stood in the world, because often, you know, as a disabled person, people are going to go, oh, that's lovely, dear, and give you a standing ovation, even if you're not very good. You know, even if you're rubbish, they'll still give you a standing ovation. And I think that is really hard to take when somebody comes and actually gives you the honesty. And I think Gordon really was very good at that. He is very good at that. And he's also very good at bringing out the potential that you have to really put you on a stage and feel confident that you don't look silly and that you're not just being put there for a tokenistic reason, you know, to tick a box.
Yeah, I mean, you've touched upon it there and talking about being patronising. I'm going to take you to a city where I DJed in my former life, spent many a night in the student unions of Dundee DJing away and missing double maths in the morning back in Glasgow, but that's another story.
Well, it's a good lesson to miss. Oh, indeed. And I didn't say that.
So I've already obviously dropped the name of the city, Dundee. Tell me about the incident at the Dundee nightclub. What happened then?
Oh, I knew you were going to bring that up. Right, okay. So what happened was that I was in a theatre production. This was Raspberry, actually, that I think I had mentioned where the cowboy song came from. And I was working on Raspberry at the time. And it was the tours in 2010. And we wanted a night out. And so we went to this hotel, the bar shut, and we wanted to carry on drinking. And I don't drink when I sing at all. I just can't, because it just kind of really dries up my throat. But I still wanted to stay out and chat with my friends. So we went to this nightclub next door to that, which was part of the same complex, you know. Mm-hmm. And I went to the door and the bouncers just took one look at my mate and said, no, she's not coming in. I was like, you what? He says, no, you're not coming in. And I was like, why? Well, you've got a stick. Yeah, it's a white cane. It's for getting around, and that's why I need it. I explained to them very nicely. I wasn't naughty, or I didn't shout, and I wasn't belligerent in any way, and I wasn't drunk. I was stone cold sober. Like I said, I never drink on tour until the last night. and so, you know, and then basically I went down to talk to them again, and then it just kind of spiraled from there. They basically said, no, you can't come in. I think you'd be better off somewhere more quiet. You shouldn't be going down steps. Our insurance won't cover it. You know, every excuse in the book. And they wouldn't let me in. Basically, what happened then was that I reported it to the press because I was so angry. And I felt really, the reason I did that was because I felt that I'm a strong person. I've got quite a lot of resilience most of the time. And I have the thick skin to sort of say, okay, it was horrible, but it's one group of idiots and whatever. But what about the next 17-year-old girl that goes there?
Absolutely.
You know, and who's lost their sight and wants to just go out with her mates and she can't because they're prohibiting and they're putting up these barriers. If I was black, they would never be able to do that. If I was in a wheelchair, they probably wouldn't. They may do it, but and I think actually that has happened.
But ultimately, any strand of, you know, disability
or
diversity,
yeah,
it just shouldn't be happening, period. So what was the snowball effect? What was the reaction?
Well, basically, I ended up coming on all sorts of radio stations. I had I don't know if it was front page in the Times, but it was quite a widespread in the Times. And it was something like Blind Girl Reads the Riot Act to Mini Hitlers or something like that. And it was really quite a strong piece. I guess I should have really taken it to court, but I didn't really feel that that's what I wanted to do. What I really wanted to do was shame them. They apologised and said, sorry, you know, the people from the hotel apologised and they were lovely to me. And I did kind of have this real guilt, even when I think about it now, I had this guilt to the staff because I know that it wasn't the staff in the hotel's fault and they were kind of being exceptionally nice to me for the whole rest of the time that I was there. But I did feel that they need to be called out. And whenever that, you know, if it was an incident of racism, this would not happen. And you can't have that. You can't have a hierarchy of minority preference in any sense, you know. And I would expect that if people made exception for me, that the same exceptions or whatever would be made for anyone else, colour, creed or whatever, you know. And it's really important that minority groups speak out against this kind of prejudice.
Absolutely. And I'm really glad that you spoke out for the visually impaired community because, yeah, I remember the reaction at the time. It did snowball and you're leaving these little traits and these challenges are leaving legacies and platforms for the next lot to come up on. So, Sally, just well done on you for doing that.
Thank you.
Tell me, when did you first start posting your own cover versions online?
There's a platform called Audio Boom that I don't really use anymore. But at the time, I've got two young kids. And when I first had my eldest daughter, who's now nearly 10, oh my goodness, she and I did quite a lot of little sound clips. So Audio Boom, if you don't know, is like kind of YouTube, but it's all in sound. Or it was at the time. I think it's kind of changed to become more podcast related now. But I think at the time it was definitely a kind of forum for people to post audio clips of their life, maybe sort of document it. So I did that. But I also did another account with me just sort of putting my songs up. I hadn't really felt that I was able to give myself a presence online before without it having to be all about visuals. And I think Audio Boom was the first time that I was able to do that without it having to be about visuals.
And we're going to hear a little something, aren't we?
Yes, you're going to hear Identity Lost. And this is one of the first songs that I ever wrote. I had a massive complex about not being able to write songs. And actually, I still do sometimes. I feel that, you know, it's quite hard for me. The process isn't easy. But I did write songs, and this was one of the first songs that I ever wrote.
Sally Clear there with Identity Lost. I'm Ravi Sagoo. You're listening to Blind Notes on RNIB Connect Radio in conversation with Sally Clay. Sally, what's the reaction been like to some of these songs?
I had some really wide variety of reactions to these songs. Most people say, oh, they're wonderful, they're great lyrics and all this stuff, which is lovely to hear. And then when I got older and I was still singing it, somebody actually said to me that they felt that it was quite a young song. And that really was a good thing because it made me think, actually, yes, it is quite a young song compared to where I'm at now emotionally. So, yeah, I've had so many different reactions, but generally positive. And even the person that said that about it being a young song was still very positive. You know, it was just more like a kind of observation. Said, I think there's more in you that you could express now. And I thought, yeah, maybe there is.
Sally, you also play the harp, which to me looks really complicated. What's the challenge of that instrument, again, for someone with a visual impairment? Because how many strings are there on a harp? I can't even count.
Well, to be honest, my foray into all these different instruments came from theatre. Basically, what happens when you're a musician in theatre, and anyone that's ever done any theatre music will back me up, is that basically what you do is you come in there and you sit down at your instrument and they go, right, play me something that's kind of a mixture of Rachmaninoff meets Duke Ellington meets Freddie Mercury. And you're like, okay, so you've got to kind of do it. And then they go, oh, that'd be really good with a bit of flute in it. Do you play flute? No. Oh, well, that's all right. You can learn it by next week. Put it in the show. And so,
No pressure.
No pressure. And so that's kind of how it all came about. And there was this one particular show that I did called Edmund the Learned Pig. And that was basically, I was playing about six different instruments in this show. And it kind of gave me a bit of a boot up the bum instrument-wise and made me think, oh, there's loads of opportunities here. And I was working with kids, doing musical workshops and stuff. And, you know, when you're working with kids in schools and stuff, sometimes you've got to bring different instruments in and show them the whole variety. So I started bringing all sorts of different instruments in, accordion. And anyway, the harp kind of emerged from just a lust to play loads of different instruments. And I felt really connected. I played on someone's harp once at a gig just for fun, you know, it was during the interval and she let me play and I thought, this is amazing. The first harp that I ever got, and it's still sitting at home in my wee box, and it's a 12-string harp. So I learned a few things on that. And then now I've got a 27-string harp.
Wow. When I was growing up, harp was a Lagerbrand, believe it or not.
Oh, yeah! A harp and lime.
Cool sharp harp.
Yeah. Oh, yeah! God, we used to get harps at school.
Let's not go there.
Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, moving swiftly on. Sally, I'm sensing that you don't take yourself too seriously, right? I don't know where I'm getting that from.
No, I don't know. I have no idea.
Not at all. And obviously, a lot of this comes out in your songs that you perform and you write. How much do you enjoy the songwriting side of things as well?
Well, actually, funny enough, you should say that because I used to hate it. And I'm doing this show at the moment with a company called Birds of Paradise and a friend of mine, Robert Softly Gale, who I think I mentioned before we met in the Threepenny Opera. He and I are doing this. It's a two-hander show and it's called the Super Special Disability Roadshow. We've done it as a film and we're now kind of getting it ready for working in theatre, hopefully next year once the restrictions are kind of eased. But yeah, so prior to doing that, I'd found songwriting. I do write songs and I have done it, but it was always with this massive degree of fear and sort of. And I've met quite a few women actually who feel like this. It's not all women, again, but just a lot of my friends who mm-hmm. are musicians. There's kind of a way that men create things and it seems so effortless and it's sort of this confidence that men have when they're creating. And I don't feel that when I create. And I know that there are many very illustrious and creative women about, but a lot of people I've quizzed on this have said that their process is very fraught with self-doubt. And I think that's how I would describe my songwriting process. It was very fraught with self-doubt until I started doing this show. And it was like, I just felt really free just to do what I felt was right. And yeah, so the songwriting process this time has been really liberating. And I think it partly is to do with the experiences that I've had in my life. I've had two children and I was quite ill after both of them. And that kind of really changed my perspective on life and gave me this, after the recovering from that and kind of realizing what I can face, has made me really strong. And I think that strength is now being injected into my songwriting.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah, this song here is kind of a silly song, really. It's called Thank You, and it's from the show, the Super Special Disability Roadshow, and it's all about sighted help, air quotes again, and it's about how sometimes it's a blessing and sometimes it's a curse. For all the times you fireman's lifted me across the road, for the time you smacked me into a pole and nearly broke my nose, I'm just so grateful for the day you stopped me while en route and fed my guide dog fish and chips so we puked all down my suit. Oh, thank you, really, but no thank you, there's no need to fuss. I wasn't really heading for the 97 bus. I'm independent, self-sufficient, please leave me alone. I'm 41, for goodness sake, I can manage on my own. Woo! Get off, what are you doing? I've just relived the moment when you nicked my sweetie stash, said you'd look after my wallet and then ran off with the cash. Oh, that time you pulled my chair away, then told me to sit down, or dyed my hair ginger and pretended it was brown. Woo! Thank you, really, but no thank you, listen now I beg. If you grab me one more time, I'll clout you round the head. I'll bash you, smash you, hit you, kick you, stab you in the eye. And while you stand there whimpering, I'll casually walk by. So if you see someone you think needs help to complete a simple task, it's really not that hard to do, 'cause all you gotta do is ask. Woo! All you gotta do, all you gotta do, all you gotta do is ask. All you gotta do, all you gotta do, all you gotta do is ask. Oi!
Sally Clay, thank you for thank you.
My pleasure for thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for thank you for thank you.
We're so awfully polite.
Yes. Yeah, I know. Marvellous.
Indeed. Let's stay away from the RPA.
Yeah, I'm not good at it.
tell me about Altogether Now. What's the concept of that show for those not familiar with it?
Okay, so you know your kind of standard TV talent shows where you've got a panel of judges, maybe three or four, and then you've got a contestant. Well, Altogether Now kind of drastically changes the size of the judging panel. So if you can imagine, you're kind of on a stage and you're facing what looks like a kind of beehive of 100 judges. So you've got like kind of columns with head and shoulders poking out of judges, and they're all kind of there watching one performer. Can you imagine how daunting that is for the performer? And then basically what happens is if any of the 100, that's what they're called, like the performance, then they stand up and at a certain point during the song, they join in. And the more stand-ups and join-ins you have, then the higher your score is. And the higher your score is, the more chance you'll have of going into the final and eventually competing to win £50,000.
So were you scouted for the show? How did you get involved?
A friend of mine, again, another Threepenny Opera connection, it was because of Gary Robson. He basically couldn't do it. I think they'd asked him to do it, so he recommended me. And I was like, no, I've got a good face for radio, but not a face for TV, blah, blah, blah. And made all these excuses, and my mates were like, go on, you've got to do it. So I said, oh, all right. And it was just the biggest, craziest experience ever. It was really very, it was like a real hardcore thing, but it was great. And I was working 15-hour days, and the dresses that everybody wore, I had to spend like £500 on dresses because it's like every day you had to have a different dress. And the things that people wore, I mean, I couldn't even see it, but I just got a sense. I mean, there was one person's dress that was so big it used to kind of generate this draft every time you walked, and that was a guy. So it was a drag artist. And I was in the 100. I was one of the judges. And actually what was great about this company was they were really accessible, very up on kind of disability politics, and they really just got it. And they also organised a technological solution to allow me to know when to stand up and sit down, because they had this kind of bit where you'd let the singer sing the song to you before pressing your buzzers. And if you couldn't see, in theory, you might not know when that was. But actually, I had a little earpiece and said, "Would you think you'd be able to feed this to my earpiece somehow?" And they just took it and ran with it. You know, it was exemplary access, and the way that they helped me fill out forms, the way that they kind of basically pampered me the whole time I was there, I thought was fantastic.
It sounds brilliant. It sounds like it was really catered for.
Yeah.
You've got two young children.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it could be easy to let a music career slip given the demands of daily life, but you've managed to keep up the music side, and you seem busier than ever with music. How important is it for you to keep music going?
I go through phases because sometimes, I mean, I actually, up until recently, and I still am doing, I'm doing a counselling course as well. And I've got my two young kids who I really value and feel really, that are an integral part of me and my life. Music took a back seat for quite a long time, especially after I was ill, but it still always keeps coming back. So I think that it is something that I have to do. It will always be there in my soul, and it will always be part of who I am.
Sally, your passion, your talent and your energy for music, it just bursts out. I mean, it really does. I'm enthused because I'm in your company. I was about to say, I'm so enthused, I'm going to go and pick up the tabla again, but I don't want to harm the tabla. So I'll just leave the tabla at the side.
I tried it as well, and right, I'm rubbish. You know,
But, you know, I'll maybe go and stick on Zakhar Hussain or something like that, you know.
Excellent.
Some of the old classical stuff, you know, in the background.
You have to get me some, he's been talking to me all about these different musicians, and I sound absolutely phenomenal, so I'm going to have to go and have a listen as well.
I'll send you in the right direction. But you're also now, you're busy with a new production.
Yep, it's called the Super Special Disability Roadshow.
Love the name. It's almost like a rap.
Yeah. Well, funnily enough, there is a rap in it, but I'm not doing it. Not yet, anyway, because I haven't finished learning all the way.
Ooh, okay. We'll save that for next time, hopefully.
Oh, it's awful. It's a really bad rap. I'm like the worst rapper ever because I'm, just not rapping material. I'm just classically trained, weird. But yeah, there is a rap in it. Yeah, but
there is a genre of classic rap as well.
Yes.
Just try to get the classical world into the rap world because you can get any music into the, you know,
it's true.
Any
it's
genre.
So true.
Yeah, so tell me about that and your role as a writer as well. So, you know, multifaceted here. What's going on?
Like I said, I've kind of struggled with a bit of mental illness and stuff, and I was really hesitant to take on anything after I had my second daughter because I was really busy with the girls. And then Robert Softly Gale kind of approached me and said, look, would you be up for doing this production? And he said, I'd actually be hiring you as writer. And my first thought was, oh, my God, no, I can't write. Oh, my God, no. And then I thought, no, you don't give in to that. You do it. So I did it. And I said yes. And I decided that I was going to write. And I was going to get over this writer's block and this fear of putting my own work out there. And so, yeah, that's what I kind of did. And I was terrified at first. I genuinely thought I was going to fail and everything was going to come crashing down. And I've actually written three songs, of which Thank You that I just wrote was one. I wrote the theme tune for the Super Special Disability Roadshow, but I also have written a song called Square Peg. And it's all about not fitting in. That feeling that I'd mentioned earlier on, the social isolation. But kind of how, I suppose, when I look at it, it's a reflective song. I mean, it might sound sad to you, but to me, it's not about sadness. It's about reflection and about how that isolation impacts on young kids and kind of informs their life.
Sally, you're going to play us out with that song, but can I just thank you from the very bottom of my heart. I've had an absolute ball today.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed coming as well. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for sharing your experiences in music. It's Sally Clayner. You've been listening to Blind Notes with me, Ravi Sagu, which is a Demos production supported by the Audio Content Fund for RNIB Connect Radio.
See you in the playground playing games and having fun. Everyone's going two by two. I'm the only one. Turning, turning, skipping ropes. My heart's against the wall. Don't understand these rules. Don't understand at all. When you're a square peg. Just to fit your frames, remolded all my contours just to be the same. Be a big girl, be a strong girl, gonna make us proud. No one's gonna hear your voice unless it's loud. You're a square peg in a round hole. A fairy cake in a jelly mold. When you're a square peg in a round hole. Am I good enough? Am I good enough? Thank you. be, just to be.